Thank you, Jewel, and thank you, Trey, for the invitation. Thank you to the district superintendents of this northern region of your conference, and I appreciate all of you being here for the chance to be here with you and share a little bit. Let me just tell you a little bit more about my history. So my first year and a half of life, I lived in northern New Jersey.
All right.
My dad was a student at Drew University Theological School. And if you were a Methodist preacher, your kid could be born free at Brooklyn Methodist Hospital. And so I was born in Brooklyn and was taken back to Drew and lived and grew up and lived there for a year and a half before my folks moved to Indiana. So I've served just a few congregations in Indiana. But I graduated in 1985. In 1986, I was appointed as the associate pastor at Broadway United Methodist Church in Indianapolis. I served there for 5.5 years. I'm going to say a few words about that in a few moments. And then I was sent to a church in South Bend, Indiana. And the name of that church was Broadway United Methodist Church. And then I was there for 11.5 years. And then 14.5 years ago, the bishop sent me back to Broadway United Methodist Church in Indianapolis. I think the bishop thinks I can only serve churches named for which is fine with me. But I grew up in small towns in southern Indiana, in Huntingburg and French Lick and Whiteland, Indiana. And people will often say to me, isn't where you are very different from where you grew up? And I say, no. There's a lot of good folks and a few scoundrels in each of those places. That's been my experience. These places are very similar, really. So, to go into my story, I came to Broadway Church in 1986 in Indianapolis. I knew, I'd learned in seminary, I was bringing the abundant life of Jesus Christ in these places. I was there to help the poor, the sick, the needy, you know, in all the ways I could. And we were an inner city church. We are an inner city church located there in Indianapolis. We had once been the largest church in Indiana, not the largest Methodist church in Indiana. We had once been the largest church in Indiana, over 3,000 people. In the late 1950s and 1960s into the early 1970s, white flight had happened. You know about this, right? This is not unknown to you all. And people had fled for the suburbs and things, but the people who lived around there and some of the other folks stayed in that place. And so when I came there, one of the things I remember the senior pastor pointing out very clearly was that people often felt like we weren't what we used to be. Remember the good old days. This never comes up. Right? And people, you know, were often thinking and remembering that time and wanting to be back to that time when there were 3,000 people all around our place and filling the sanctuary, filling the community room. We have a really big building. We have 9 kitchens in our building.
Wow.
We have 27 bathrooms.
Woo!
Yes, I mean, just to give you a little picture of this place. When I got there back then in those years, there were 150 or so people. So, that they had a very active and vital outreach ministry. And that was my job. I was the neighborhood pastor, the pastor in the streets. So I knew what I was going to do. And the first thing was to work with the summer program. And the summer program when I got there was basketball for boys and cheerleading for girls. And very painfully, we changed it. We built each week around a spiritual principle. We started every day with devotions. We ended every day with devotions. We had art, music, Bible study, history, singing, just everything you could imagine. We had recreation for a healthy body and education for the human spirit. 250 young people, 9 to 5 every day. Broke my arm patting myself on the back. I felt so good. It was great. But the last 9 months I was there in 1991, I did 9 funerals for young men under 25 years old in the 4-block radius around our church building. 9 funerals. Many of them young people who'd grown up in programming of the church. And this really hit my heart hard. I was trying to figure, I thought I was doing good work here. I thought I was doing God's work. I thought I was bringing the abundant life to this place. And 9 young people dying in 9 months? I wasn't being nearly as helpful as I thought. And I would say this to people, and people would say, oh, no. You know, if you hadn't been doing this, it would have been even worse. And I said 2 things. One is, you're wrong. And the second is, even if you're right, this isn't good enough. 9 young people died. So it's around this time that the bishop sends me up in January 1st of 92 to go to Broadway Church in Indianapolis, in South Bend. And I get up there, and it's a tiny little church in the inner city of South Bend, 40 people in church on Sunday morning. And we had a food pantry there at that church, and we got government surplus food. And because we got government surplus food, we had a government surplus form that you had to fill out. Right? How much is your income? How much are your expenses? And people would say, well, my income is $600 a month, and my expenses are $1,200. A congregation of 40 people. What could we do with that? The largest growth group in our congregation was single mothers with children. We didn't have deep pockets there. So we're going through, and the second board meeting, I remember my second administrative board meeting at that church, and the treasurer says, I don't know if we have enough money to stay open much longer, so if we've got to close, let's just save enough so we can throw one heck of a party. Man, do I have something to learn here about the abundant life they knew. I mean, and I was thinking about this church back in Indianapolis that had over 3 times the amount of people that this church had, but was all the time complaining about what they didn't have, what they used to have. And these people are saying, let's just save enough to throw one heck of a party. So we come to Pentecost in 1992. And every Sunday at that little church, we would have lunch after church for whoever wanted to come and eat. And so lots of people came. And wherever the preacher sat, the table at which the preacher sat, you could come and talk about the sermon. So we're sitting there at the table. It's like 45 minutes later. And this woman says, you know, you said that Peter, reading from the book of the prophet Joel, said that God's Spirit flows down on all people, young and old, women and men, just like in your prayer this morning, right? And I said, yes. And I thought, man, I am really good. It's over half an hour later, and she remembers what I said. I'm awesome. I'm a great preacher. Yes, that's right. She says, so why don't we treat people like that?
Whoa.
I said, what do you mean? She said, well, when people come to the food pantry, we ask people how poor they are. If we believe God's Spirit flow down on all people, young and old, women and men, doesn't that mean the people who came to our food pantry too? Yes. So the very next day, we started asking people when they showed up what their gifts were. We didn't ask them the spiritual gifts questionnaire that you often fill out in churches. We asked people like, have you taken care of older folks? Have you taken care of children? Have you done it because they're members of your family? Because you want to help somebody out? You know, because had a job somewhere. Can you fix a toaster? Can you drive a car? Do you play a musical instrument? Do you sing? Do you grow things? Do you grow flowers? Do you grow vegetables? Have you cooked for more than 10 people? Have you cleaned up after more than 10 people? Just all sorts of questions. 10 pages of questions. I got to tell you, people didn't really believe you wanted to know. But halfway through 10 pages, they're starting to believe maybe you're really serious. So one of the first people who came to us was a little woman about this tall, lived half a block from the church, named Adele Almaguer. Adele lived with 3 generations of her family in this house, and she said she was a good cook. So we said, prove it. She said, what do you mean? You're a cook, the custodian, secretary, and pastor, lunch on Friday. So she cooked for us, and it was fabulous. So the leadership of the neighborhood organization was meeting. We said, don't meet somewhere else. Meet here at the church and let Adele cook for you. So they did. They paid her for it. They loved it. It was great. Over the next 9 months, Studebaker Elementary School in our neighborhood needed somebody to cook for their parent-teacher meeting. So we encouraged them to hire Adele, which they did. They loved it. Southeast Side Neighborhood Health Center in our neighborhood had an open house. They needed food. She provided it.
Mm-hmm.
Memorial Hospital in South Bend had a press conference in our neighborhood. They needed food. She provided it. Well, then we get a call from the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have an all-day meeting of our leadership program in your church building. We'll have 70 of the civic leaders there. Can we do that? And we said, well, that day works. Yes, we can work that out. They said, since we're going to be there all day, we need to use your kitchen. We said, you can use our kitchen, but we would prefer you use our catering room.
Yeah.
I said, okay. We took $20. We bought her 1,000 business cards. It said, La Chaparita Catering, Spunky Tex-Mex. She fed 70 of the business and civic leaders in the community. They passed out her business card to everybody there. Through that, she got connected to the Michiana Business Women's Association. And a year and a half later, she opened up Adelita's Fajitas at the corner of 8th and Harrison in Elkhorn. Now, if we had said when she showed up, tell us how poor you are, we would have all ended up poorer for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have missed a lot of great food. John 10:10, Jesus says, I come that you may have life abundant. It isn't life abundant. It doesn't say, I come that you may have life abundant when your pocketbook's full, when your bank account's full, when you're healthy, when you're well, everything. It says, I come that you may have life abundant.
Praise
right here, right now, this is true.
Yes,
Matthew 11. You remember Matthew 11? John the Baptist is in jail, and he says to his disciples, go ask Jesus if he's the one. And he goes, and he says, Jesus says to the disciples, go back and tell John. The blind see, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news, and blessed is the one who takes no offense at me. Do any of you know the writer, she's been dead for a while, but Flannery O'Connor, any of you ever heard of her? She wrote a novel called Wise Blood. It was made into a movie a long time ago, but there's a novel called Wise Blood. And in Wise Blood, there's a character named Hazel Moats. And Hazel is a pastor. Hazel is a pastor in the Church of Christ without Jesus. Where the blind don't see, the deaf don't hear, and them that's dead stays that way. But this was her critique of the church. And all of a sudden I realized it was her critique of me. I thought I was the one bringing this. I thought I was the one with abundant life to offer, the abundant life of Jesus Christ, rather than knowing and seeing and believing that the abundant life was active right in front of my very eyes, in front of the very people who I thought needed me. And all of a sudden it began to dawn on me, these people aren't needy, they're needed. What am I going to do? This stuff is flipping everything in my life. I'm beginning to see this stuff different. So when you're the pastor of a church, and this happens sometimes, and you may know about this, right? That people come and ask to do community service, you know, because the courts told them to. And in our neighborhood in South Bend, 90% of the arrests for prostitution happened in our neighborhood. Now let me say 90% of the people who were arrested weren't from our neighborhood.
Okay.
But it's where most people were arrested, right? So this woman came to see me. Her name was Lucy. She told me that she had to do community service, and would I give her some community service to do? And well, I said, well, what was your crime? Which I always ask, because you need to know. We had children around our building, other things, you need to know this, right? And it took her half an hour to tell the pastor that it was prostitution. Now, sometimes I speak before I think. I don't know if I'm alone in this room without it. But I'm trying to think, what can we have this woman doing, right, in our place? And before I can stop myself, I hear myself saying, so what are you good at? And she says, I'm really good with people. And so we put her to work providing hospitality. We came to the building. Our building, big old building, you know, confusing about where to go. And she would meet people at the door. She'd get people a cup of coffee. She'd direct them to where they're going. And she was great. Everybody has a gift. Absolutely every single person has a gift. And it's a sin to waste it. And the question and the challenge that I have been on this journey of is, how do I really pay attention to what God is doing in the lives of people? You know, in 1 Corinthians, first chapter, Paul writes and says, now remember who you were, dear sisters and brothers. For from a human point of view, few of you were wise or powerful or of high social standing. But God purposely chose what the world considers weak in order to shame the strong. And God purposely chose what the world considers foolish in order to shame the wise. Mm-hmm. And God purposely chose what the world looks down on and despises and thinks of as nothing in order to destroy what the world thinks of as important. I had memorized that scripture as a kid, but I hadn't lived it. I had been acting like God wasn't active and present and alive in the people around me. You know that food pantry survey when people came? We asked people three questions at the end. What three things do you do well enough you could teach somebody else how to do it? What three things would you like to learn that you don't already know? And who besides God and me is going with you along the way? Well, one of the first people, as people came, they would fill out these things, and so like Adele put down, she could teach Mexican cooking. Yes, she could. And people would put down other things. And I didn't really think about it or do anything with it. And then my oldest son, who was at the time 5 years old, needed to go to kindergarten. And so I enrolled him in kindergarten and I went over and got him going in there at kindergarten. And when I did that, they also said, would you be able to volunteer in the school office? And I wrote, yes. And they said, do you know how to use a computer? I wrote, yes. And they said, do you have a flexible schedule? I'm a pastor. Yes. Nobody called me. And that felt lousy. Wow. And I realized I'd been asking people for a year who came to our food pantry what they did well enough they could teach somebody else how to do, and they never asked them to do it. So we started something at our place we called the School of the Spirit. And we invited people to teach. We said, we won't get students for you. You've got to get your own students. But if you can get three people to show up, you can use one of the rooms in the church. And we'll put a coffee can in the room. And if any of your students put money in it, you'll get to keep it. So we had classes in Mexican cooking, basic auto repair, singing, painting, the history of the Hollywood Western and why black men were left out, Tai Chi, conversational physics. The guy who taught conversational physics, I remember when he had been filling out that form, and he was a guy who lived on the street. And he said he could teach conversational physics. And I said, what? And he said, you didn't think I was always a junkie, did you? Well, sorry. He said, I was working on my PhD in Notre Dame in physics before I got hooked on this stuff. I didn't know. I never looked. You know, there's more stories of Jesus healing people of blindness, particular stories of Jesus healing people of blindness than of healing anything else. And do you know why? Because it's the biggest problem we have.
Yeah.
It was the biggest problem I had. Rachel is one of the pastors I worked with at Broadway. She went and met with a group of young people who are blind. And she said to them, how does the seeing world treat you? And they said, that's the wrong language. And she said, I don't understand what you mean. And they said, it's not the seeing world, it's the sight world. And she said, I don't understand what you mean. And they said, just because you have sight doesn't mean you can see. Right there in front of me all the time, these gifts, and I was walking by them. because I was wanting to be helpful. I was wanting to be the Savior. I was bringing the abundant life. It was me. I was helping. Rather than seeing and recognizing God's abundant life and presence in these unexpected places. So anyway, just to go back to the school for a minute. So the school went for several years. We would do, you know, several weeks of classes, and we could come and the teachers got. Some of the classes were so well attended that we decided we would charge up front for the classes that were really well attended. They got at least 7 students. You'd have to pay $49 up front. And the teacher got to keep all of it. So the Noble newspaper did a story about this. We called it, by the way, Broadway University. We called it Old BU. So we advertised it was in the paper. They did the story about it. We get a call at the church. Hey, we'd like to take the class in conversational psychics. And I said, well, no, I'm sorry, it's conversational physics. And I said, oh, well, then we're not interested at all. And I was thinking later, what's a class of conversational psychics? It's really quiet because everybody knows what each other is thinking. God's abundant life is joyful. It's present. It's here. When I was doing the things I'd been doing before, it was miserable. It was tough. We were always, and it would, the other stuff is tough too. Dealing with the abundance is tough. But if I want to have something be tough, I want it to be something tough that I actually believe in. And I realized that I was doing stuff all along that I actually didn't believe in. But it was just what I was taught to do. Do you know how in recovery movements we say, you don't think your way into new ways of acting, you act your way into new ways of thinking? I've been acting these ways even though I didn't think this way, and it was causing me to see people not the way in which God had created them, but in which I had created them. And let me tell you, it's a lot better how God creates people than me. To begin to see that joy and that life. So I come back to Broadway Church in Indianapolis. And they've been running the summer program in the 11 years I've been gone the same way as when I left. It wasn't bad. It was good. There were lots of people who came. But it wasn't changing anything. Right? It wasn't bad. It even helped a few people beat the odds. But we were talking and saying, you know, maybe the work isn't helping a few people beat the odds. Maybe it's recognizing that God has already changed the odds and we should get on board. So, how do we do that? So we talked about it for a few years. And then I remember, and I can't remember who it was, but I remember somebody talking about a few years ago, discernment by nausea. Do you know what this is? You know, when you know something has to change, God's laid it on your heart, and you know it's not going to be fun, and people aren't going to be happy about it. Have you ever experienced that? Yeah. And so got the whole people who worked in the summer program, people in the congregation, people who me and said, we aren't going to do the summer program anymore. What do you mean? Why not? Well, it doesn't do bad, but in what we believe in, right? We believe God's Spirit flows down in all people, and we're here teaching classes to people who we believe have God's Spirit in them, have something to teach. You know, how do we build on that? And what about the fact that we only run something for 250 young people around here? What about, you know, there are more than 15,000 people who live in our neighborhood. Why are we doing it like this? So we talked and prayed together for several days, and we decided that we were going to change, and this is what we were going to do. We were going to hire young people in our neighborhood, and we were going to pay them to meet their neighbors. And they do 3 things. They name the gifts, talents, dreams, and passions they see in the lives of their neighbors. They lay hands on them and bless them. And they connect them to other people who care about the same thing, both inside and outside of the community. So, for example, when I was there in the 80s, I did something before it was cool. I did community gardens. And when he did those community gardens, there were a couple plots just within the block radius of the church, and we would do those, and often people at the church would take leadership in how those would do, and not people who lived around there. And people who lived around there would often complain about the gardens some, but and sometimes complain about people taking stuff from the gardens, or sometimes, you know, somebody hasn't weeded there recently, and what are you doing about that? Now, that's a good question. So when we had the young people go out and find the gifts of people around, they come back and they showed me that there were over 50 gardeners in the five-block radius around the church. Well, I didn't know that because I thought these people were poor. They need me to do community gardens for them. Not, they're growing gardens in their backyards, in their front yards, in their side yards, on their porches. Miss Jackson grows beans on her front porch to eat and for shade. I walk by that house all the time, but I didn't see it because I was blind to God's abundance. So we say, okay, we got all these gardeners. Okay, what do we do with that? So we hired a couple of young people from the neighborhood, Kyle and Adam, and we paid them to go meet the gardeners and to ask all the gardeners what they grew, what they did with what they grew, whether they were interested in selling what they grew. And if they did, how would they like to have that happen? Would they like people to come to their houses? Would they like to take them somewhere so that people could pick them up? Would they want to do a farmer's market? How would they like to do this? So they began to have that conversation. I mentioned to you my son, my oldest son, who was going to kindergarten years ago in South Bend. Well, now he's a freshman. He was a freshman in college. And he just came back from college in May. This is 2008. Comes back from college in May of 2008. And he comes back home and he says, I'm feeling confused. And we said, okay, what's happening? And he said, well, I went to dinner with my friends last night, and when the waitress asked what we wanted to drink, I couldn't think of the word water. And when she asked what we wanted to eat, I realized I couldn't read the menu, so I tried to say chicken, but she didn't seem to understand, so I just pointed at the picture of the chicken. And I knew all my friends who I was sitting with, but I couldn't think of any of their names. What's going on? So we, of course, immediately get him to the doctor, and by the end of the next day, after a series of tests, we know he has a brain tumor on the language and thought part of his brain. Now, let me just jump ahead to tell you now, he's 28 years old, he has a really good job in Chicago, and he's getting married in October. So, I just don't want you worrying the rest of the story. You're able to hear it because you're worried about what's going to happen to this son. So on June 27, 2008, he had an awake craniotomy. That's where they open your skull and operate on you while you're awake and you're talking to them, and they take the tumor out while you're doing that. Well, 2 weeks before the surgery, the neurosurgeon calls our son, and he says, hey, Ted Kennedy's just been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and we think a story about brain tumors would be really good on CNN, and would you be willing to do a story on CNN about your brain tumor? And he said, no. He's a pure science and math nerd. No, I'm not going to do that. Great. So, a couple days later, we go to the neurosurgeon getting ready for the surgery, and the neurosurgeon says, well, Connor, would you talk to me about this? It's okay if you don't want to, but would you talk to me about it a little more? Sure, I'll talk to you about it a little more. So he says, you know, I'd really like you to think about this. This surgery is really important, and there are sometimes people who are too afraid to have it. And if they see a 19-year-old kid from the Midwest having the surgery, maybe they won't be so afraid, and they'll have the surgery. And Connor said, I'm afraid to have the surgery. And he said, well, would you think about it? Connor says, yes, I'll think about it. And we're, okay. So a couple days later, Connor comes to me and says, Dad, I'm willing to do this, but I want you to talk to the people at the hospital about something. So he tells me what he wants. So I call up the CEO's office, and he's on vacation. So he sent me to the second in command. And again, I didn't know any of these people. So I go to see him, and I say to him, so Connor's willing to do this, but he knows this will be good value for the hospital. So the only way he'll do this is if he promised to do 10 more of these surgeries for people who can't afford them otherwise. And he says, okay. And he said, great, we'd like that in writing. Which he agrees to do, and he does. But then he says, you know, I hear good things about your church. What's going on over there? I don't know, I'm thinking about my son. You know, but that morning we met with Kyla and Adam. And I told them about what they were doing, about talking with all the gardeners in the neighborhood. And what they were doing about that. And he got very excited. He said, wow, could they do a farmer's market here at the hospital? And I said, no. And he said, no. I said, no, they're just starting to have these conversations. It would take years to build infrastructure, you know. And he says, well, we have seed money for that. And I thought, great, $50 for seeds. And he said, $40,000. And I said, there's some people you should talk to. None of that would have ever happened if we were paying attention to what was wrong with humans, what was missing. So, a farmer's market at a hospital, nobody's getting rich off this, right? Mm-hmm. But it's by the poor farmers of our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Nobody's getting rich, but do you know what's happening?
Yeah.
People are getting jobs.
That's right.
Because people at the hospital are seeing people in all the time, offering their fruits and vegetables, they're talking to people, they're having conversations. You know how people get jobs, right?
Right.
Somebody knows you. Somebody who has a job knows you. Knows you. That's, and one of the other things is, because we're a church, so we know nothing about evaluation. I don't know if any of you else have this, but we don't know how to evaluate things. So we went to the School of Public Health at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, IUPUI, or as they say in Indianapolis, Ooey Pooey. And we said to them, we're a church, we know nothing about this. Can you evaluate this? And they came back and they started evaluating this. And one of the things they said is, you know, as a result of people selling their produce at the hospital, more people in your neighborhood are growing produce. And not only are more people growing produce, but that means more people are eating it.
Mm-hmm.
And because more people are eating it, there's less hypertension.
Mm.
Oh. God's weaving at work. Dr. King said years ago, we are all tied together in an inescapable network. Yes, yes, yes. So we began, we just kept thinking about this. So we run a tutoring program for 30 years. When I was there in the 80s, I really felt good because I really improved it. We got 50 tutors doing one-on-one tutoring 3 nights a week. It was great. How did I know? The funders told me so.
Yeah.
You have 150 volunteer hours, you know, every week going on with this. You have 50 children who are in there getting tutored. You know what nobody ever asked us? Did it make anything better? When we went back and looked at the statistics, every year we ran the tutoring program, the graduation rate in our neighborhood got worse. We had never looked at that. Now again, it didn't get worse because of what we were doing. What we were doing was good, but it wasn't helping what we thought it was helping.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we were doing something. So when I would get tutors for that tutoring program, I would get tutors from our church, I would get tutors from Meridian Street United Methodist Church, St. Luke's United Methodist Church, Carmel United Methodist Church, I'd get tutors from United Way, I'd get tutors from Lilly Pharmaceutical. You know who I never got tutors from?
Mm.
The neighborhood. Because these people are poor.
Mm.
They don't know this. So these young people finding out the gifts of people, I get a call, you got to talk to Maya. Who's Maya? She lives 3 blocks from the church. You got to talk to Maya. Well, who's Maya? Well, she runs tutoring out of her house. So I call Maya. She's 34 years old. She lives in the house her parents raised her in. She works at AT&T at nights. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, when she gets up, the kids from her block come over to her house during the summer. And I say, well, what do you cover with them? And she says, I cover everything from phonics to Sophocles. I said, what do you mean? She said, if they don't know how to read, we do phonics. If they do know how to read, we do Sophocles. And then every Friday, I have a barbecue in my backyard, and their families come over. And their families come over, and they present what they've learned that week. We shouldn't be saying to her, hey, come tutor in our program. We should be saying, Maya, how can we be a part of what God's doing with your work?
Yeah.
So we invite her to church. Right? We do this thing in church that before the last hymn on the last Sunday of every month, where we celebrate ministries that have died, ministries that are continuing, and ministries that are beginning. And we do this before, again, the last 10 every month. And we have a little group in our church. It's made up of three people. They're called the Animators of the Spirit. And they don't have a regular meeting, but anytime anybody in the church wants to meet with them, they have to meet. And anybody in the church or in the community at large who wants to come and talk about some call or claim of God they think upon their lives, they can come talk with the animators. And the animators do three things. They ask discerning questions. They point out where dragons lie. And they pray for and encourage the people in what they're doing. So, Maya's doing this. So the animators say, we want to celebrate Maya before the last hymn. So Maya comes to worship. She's lived in our neighborhood her whole life, 34 years. She's never set foot in our place. And do you know how I know? Because she sits in the front row. She's all dressed up and she says, I'm not going to get up in front of people and talk because I'm too shy. But I'll talk to people afterwards if people want to come and talk with me. So, before the last hymn, the animators get up and they say, Maya, stand up. And Maya stands up, but her back's to the congregation because she's in the front row. And they describe what Maya's doing with her ministry there. And they say to the crowd, will those of you who will support Maya with your prayers, your presence, your gifts, your service, and your witness, you recognize those words? Your prayers, your presence, your gifts, your service, and your witness, please stand. Well, now, everybody's standing, but she doesn't know that because she's in the front row. So then they steal a little bit from the wedding liturgy. Will all of you do everything in your power to uphold and care for this person in her ministry? If so, you answer, we will. And people say, we will. And when the crowd, you know, shouts, we will, she does this. And when she lands, two things that had been invisible are now visible. We had not known. They are remarkable, good, holy people living out of that sense of God's abundance, doing what God has called them to do all around us in the community. And she had not known. There is a community, a body of Christ here, that is ready and willing to support and invest in and encourage and bless her in what she is doing. The work, the calling that we have is to make the invisible visible. Mm-hmm. Who else is going to do this? Who else? We have eyes to see and ears to hear. So Jesus continually talks about, reveals this. Of course, the story we all know of God's abundance that Jesus tells is the one miracle that appears in all the Gospels, right? It's the feeding of the multitudes of 5,000. In John, in that story, it says that Jesus told the disciples to gather up the fragments. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember what happens? They gather up more than they started with.
Yeah.
Right? So that's in John 6. I told you at the beginning of this about John 10, where Jesus says, I come that you may have life abundant. When he says gather up the fragments, it's the same word there that's used in John 10 when he says, I come to bring you the abundance. He's saying to disciples, he's saying to us, gather up the abundance. It's there. It's already there. It doesn't matter how big, how small, anything. It's there. Act like it.
Mm.
One of the things in the congregation that I learned up there in South Bend is that, you know, this abundant life didn't have much to do with how many people were in the pews. We, you know, over those 11 years, it grew from 40 to 90 people. But those 90 people, man, they saw God's abundance, and they'd been seeing it before I got there, and they helped me to see it. They gave me eyes to see and ears to hear, where I have been blind and not seeing it. Because I was so intent on me being the Savior. Right? On me helping. On me saving. And it was God in Christ who was doing it all the way along, all around us. all our practices, unfortunately, are oriented around need. We're often told to do need surveys, right? Find out what's wrong. What do we do with what's wrong or what's missing? Let me tell you, I have a problem with my heart. It sometimes beats at 300 beats to a minute. That's not good, by the way. It's a form of tachycardia. And when this happens, we have to call the ambulance, and the ambulance comes, and they give me this drug that causes my heart to stop, and then it restarts, or always has so far, at the lower rate, you know. My congregation can't use what's wrong with my heart. They can only use what I have to offer. What if we treated our communities as not with what there's missing, but with what they have? God in Christ is active and present, continuing to encourage and bless us through the lives of our community. The question is always, will all of us have the eyes to see and the ears to hear? And then, will we have the practices to act on? I already told you, I was asking people about their gifts, but then I didn't do anything about it. It took me being treated like that before I could see the way I was treating other people. When the school didn't call me, oh, this is exactly how I would treat. If I asked you all to stand up and turn to each other and tell each other what's wrong with you, that would not be an enjoyable conversation in particular, right? And most of you wouldn't tell the truth. I'm not saying all of you. I'm just saying my experiences with me. But I know the same thing can happen also with gifts. You might ask me, Mike, what are your gifts? And I might tell you, I'm a really good singer. Anybody who stands next to me would not agree with me. And it's not because I'm lying. In my head, I think I'm a good singer. But if you ask me, what do the people who love you, what would they tell you? What would they tell you your gifts are? Then I start singing. Over and over again, which I find great comfort in this, Jesus is always giving the disciples a hard time, right? Just always throughout the Gospels. You know, you aren't seeing, you aren't understanding. Again, I find great comfort in this. They began to find a way, and at Pentecost, this became really clear, to recognize that God's Spirit flows down on all people, young and old, women and men. And I hope we at Broadway, I hope for you all, that we can continue to live into what it means to be a Pentecost church, finding abundance in unexpected.